Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Max Verstappen had pole position, then he didn't. Ferrari had control, then they didn't. And on a day when any one of the drivers from the big three teams might have won, it was Lewis Hamilton who came through to win the Mexican Grand Prix. I'm your host, Ed Straw, and joining me in my hotel room in Mexico City's reformer area first is Scott Mitchell, a very angry Scott Mitchell. Not quite as angry as you were a few minutes ago, though.
No, I think anger has given way to delirium, I think, and as evening sets in on Sunday evening here in Mexico. I think we were all absolutely furious because we had a long day at the track, finally get back. You know, there's still a bit of work to do, got a podcast to do. So you dive in to a well-known fast food establishment.
Scottish sounding.
The Golden Arches welcoming you on arrival. And what can only be described as the single worst eating experience of my life. I've never waited more than half an hour for fast food before. And then when it came out, it was absolutely dreadful.
In an establishment with no queue?
No, but with plenty of staff sort of faffing around behind the counter, apparently sort of creating everything one bit at a time. So, you know, that was a lovely end to the day, I'm sure. We all thought we were actually going to have quite a sensible finish, and it was actually going to be quite pleasant. I'm just pleased that the anger has genuinely given way to just being a bit mad at this time now.
You were even more angry than I was when I couldn't find the Uber pickup spot that was badly signposted outside the circuit.
You were furious about that, but I think you were angrier when you were absolutely baffled by how to undo a plastic straw.
Yeah, despite my name, I struggled massively with that earlier. But anyway, we've also got Jack Bennion, fresh from his first Grand Prix for Autosport. Now, we've got to tie up a loose end. You set a trivia question on the last episode of the podcast. What was that question?
It's a pretty impressive debut, wasn't it? I managed to give you a pterodactyl impression and revolutionise the podcast by giving you a trivia question. I'm glad I got revolutionised out there perfectly first time out.
I should just say that Jack Bennion at this stage is sort of luxuriating on my bed at the moment. I'm sort of sat on the edge on the corner.
Bennion wants you to paint him like one of your French girls, Ed.
It's that sort of thing. It's all a bit, yeah.
I did suggest I was going to do the podcast upside down, so this is probably the best option. But we should clear up at this point that the trivia question was who scored their only Formula One points during the Mexican Grand Prix in 1989.
Which touring car
on our anniversary. And I did give the clue of which touring car legend. And Andy Hicks was the first person to get it right, as far as we know from being tagged on Twitter. And also Paul Gibson got the answer correct as well. So if you were wondering what the answer was, it was Gabriele Tarquini in an AGS.
Absolutely. It's always good to get some Gabriele Tarquini on here. I enjoyed it when he came back with Tyrrell for that one-off in 95 when Katayama was injured.
Oh, Gabriele Tarquini.
I love a one-off comeback. And Tarquini's still going strong. A great driver. Shall we get on with things and actually talk about the Mexican Grand Prix? Now, Jack, before we get into the race, we're going to have to tackle what happened at the end of qualifying. Valtteri Bottas crashed out of turn 16. Max Verstappen steamed past on his pole position lap. Did he deserve the three-place grid penalty?
Do I have to answer that with a yes or no, or can I talk about it? It felt like a very, did he deserve the penalty? Say yes or no.
Well, did he deserve a penalty? Oh. Say yes or no, then elaborate.
I'm going to say no.
Ooh.
Is that controversial?
Very. Continue. Oh. I like a debate.
It's difficult. Obviously, Valtteri Bottas took out the sensor box, so that made it very difficult for Max. The setup's really quite odd on that corner, isn't it? Because the yellow flag's on the outside of the corner on the left-hand side when the drivers are all looking at the apex to the right. So very difficult for Max to see it. Obviously, they didn't investigate until a little bit later on, and it was after Max made his comments in the press conference where he was quite bullish about leaving it to the drivers to decide. I don't want to put too many words in his mouth in this conversation, but obviously saying that the drivers should be trusted. They've got to Formula One at this, and they're at this level, so they should be trusted as such. So, bit of a difficult one. I think his second lap was good enough for pole, and I think they should have disallowed the first lap and not penalised him. That being said, I thought personally his reaction was a little bit on the aggressive side for how he should have put across his argument for maybe not a mistake, but obviously missing that yellow flag. I don't think the punishment fit the crime in this case.
I'm inclined to disagree. Fair Sebastian enough. Vettel saw the yellow flag. He slowed down. That wasn't a problem. And it ultimately, it's a safety issue. What you say about the fact that the LED panel wasn't operating, yeah, that is a mitigation, which I could say justifies maybe giving a three-place grid penalty rather than a five-place. But it's their job to see it. It's a safety issue. And for me, the safety issues are not the ones that you play with. You know, there have been serious consequences to people not respecting yellow flags as much as they should do. I don't want to go too much into what I'm referring to there, but it's not something to be trifled with. And the worst thing is, if you don't penalise, I was speaking to one former Grand Prix driver in the paddock after it, he said, if they don't penalise, then you are not going to lift for yellows in future.
I understand that there is an element of being realistic with this sort of thing. And when I asked Lewis Hamilton on Saturday about the incident and the fact that it was a single waved yellow rather than a double, so how much of a difference does that make? Because Lewis was quite impassioned about how much you need to respect double wave yellows in particular.
Although interestingly, there was some procedural issue there, because the race information board said double wave yellow, so it should have been.
But it wasn't. So I asked Lewis and said, does it really make a difference? And he said it does, because double wave yellows, you're in the pre-event notes issued by the race director, the drivers are told single wave yellow, you have to show you have to be able to show that you clearly recognised it and made an effort to back off, be prepared to change direction, that sort of thing. Double wave yellows, non-negotiable, you have to abort the lap. So there is a clear difference, and there's also a clear difference in the way that the drivers react. In Lewis's words, if you see a single wave yellow, you lift off and then you get straight back on, and the time loss is negligible, but there's basically a clear bit of data that shows that you acknowledged it. And even as basic in levels as karting, you're taught immediately to slow down and put your hand up to show that you've recognised the yellow. Now, Max didn't ignore the yellow on purpose. I actually believe he didn't see it.
That's perfectly plausible.
As Benyon said, it's on the left-hand side. It's coming around that long curved right-hander. Your natural vision is going to be to look ahead to the right, so you won't be focusing on that. Plus, you've got the added distraction of the car that's crashed. So I actually think Max's case for missing it is completely valid. And I suspect if he'd actually been a bit more circumspect after qualifying, he might have got away with just having that second lap time deleted, because that is an option available to the stewards.
And his previous lap was actually good enough for pole.
Exactly. So he didn't need to keep his foot pinned. It's almost like he did it to prove a point, because he said that he noticed that there was a crash car. And while, as I think I've said to you, Ed, and a couple of other people, a crashed car doesn't mean that you actually have to back off. There's no rule that says that.
Yeah, because Lewis Hamilton, who Verstappen complained about not being penalised, he had the tiniest lift, but he didn't really back off. But because the yellow flag wasn't out, it didn't matter.
Exactly. So while I accept that it's a slightly difficult one, I believe that if it was in... If he hadn't said what he said afterwards, I think if he'd gone to the stewards and said, my bad, I didn't see it, I kept my foot in because I didn't think I was in any danger of going off where Bottas went off, I saw the crash car, I wasn't going to hit it, I think he might have had half a chance of getting away with a reprimand or something like that. I'm not saying that the stewards 100% did it because he showed such a lack of contrition afterwards, but it can't possibly have helped, and I just think it was such a needless thing to do. And it disappointed me, because I'm a fan of Max and what he does, and I'm an admirer of how much mature he's got over the last 12 months. But it was just an indicator of, on track, he's still capable of these moments of maybe not the sharpest bit of thinking, and then off track he sort of compounds it by sort of saying things that, you know, ultimately he was just being honest, but maybe he was a bit too honest for his own good.
Yeah, possibly, but. I mean, they could have given him a bigger penalty, ultimately, and I think they had to do something, because otherwise you just set a dangerous precedent. I just think you can't, no matter what the circumstances, if there's a yellow flag there, it's the driver's responsibility to spot it.
And there is precedent, because last year in China, Marcus Ericsson improved under a double wave yellows and got a 5-place grid penalty and points on his licence. This was a lesser transgression. It was single wave yellows, not a double wave yellow. And Max has been given a slightly more lenient penalty for it. So I think it's perfectly in line with what you should do and the stewards do in these circumstances.
So that, of course, promoted Charles Leclerc to pole position. He was actually rather lucky there, because Sebastian Vettel was about to outpace him. Leclerc had been all over the place in the last sector. The rear had given up as he turned in the right-hander into the stadium. So the rears were gone. So it would have been Vettel who was ahead had that crash not happened, but then again, Verstappen would still have been ahead. But Scott Lewis Hamilton, who started third, now he almost didn't make it through the first lap with the goings on, and he really wasn't happy with Sebastian Vettel squeezing him onto the grass on the run to the first corner, was he?
No, he wasn't. But I think that did subside after the race, when in the FIA press conference, Vettel explained, or well, claimed that he didn't see Hamilton, and as soon as he saw him, he stopped squeezing him onto the edge of the track and beyond. But Hamilton wasn't happy about that. He said that that sort of thing risks a big collision, especially if you go wheel to wheel at those speeds. But once he'd sort of backed out of that, avoided the collision, he then, on the run down to turn one, I was under attack from the penalised Verstappen. And then Lewis's version of events, they sort of differs slightly to what actually happened in reality. He seems to think that Max torpedoed him into the first corner, but Max was actually perfect. Max was alongside him, basically.
And he ran him out wide.
He ran him out wide, but it was... yeah, exactly. Especially as Max was on the inside. And as plenty of stewards' decisions over the last few months, since Austria pretty much has validated, the car on the outside has a responsibility to avoid an incident, because by being on the outside, you put yourself in harm's way, basically. So Lewis was run wide. Got onto the curb on the outside of turn one, thought that he'd been hit from behind because he got such a kick of oversteer, basically. But he did a really good job not to, one, spear right completely into Verstappen, and two, T-bone Vettel.
I feel a lot of drivers might have ended up taking out both of them.
Yeah, he did a great job. And Toto Wolff even said after the race that Lewis has got this knack of just managing to avoid race-ending situations. He's very good at it. But unfortunately for Verstappen, Max ended up being collateral at this point, because Lewis did gather it up. He didn't smash into anybody, but he did run off the road going into turn two, and then he took Max with him because Max was on the outside of turn two at this point, so they both went over the grass. And at that point, Wolf said that he just felt like this was just going to be one of those Mexican Grand Prix. The last two haven't been very good for Mercedes performance wise. Verstappen won in 2017 and 2018, and Wolff sort of saw that all happening again as he saw his lead driver skate across the grass and the Ferraris canter off into a 1-2. But obviously, the race 70 laps later was quite a different picture to the one after a couple of corners.
At this point, I'd like to add some colour to the readers, if that's right, Viewed. But while Scott's facing us as he talks, behind him the TV is on, as I'm a big American football fan and also basketball fan, and we're in the perfect time zone to watch those. But they finish now, and the just as you were describing, the Lewis gathering up the moment there and Max being forced off, it was played behind you on the screen, so we got to re-watch it while you were talking about it. And you did a great job, I've got to say. Fantastic commentary.
Acceptable description. Very, very, very well done. But of course, yeah, that put Hamilton in an awkward position, with Leclerc leading from Vettel. Albon up into third place. And in fact, Carlos Sainz squeezed past Verstappen and Hamilton as they were heading off the track and was up into fourth. So for that bit of the race anyway, the McLaren's very prominent as Lando Norris was also there. But then it came down to starting to kind of eliminate contenders, and the first to remove himself from contention, Jack, was Max Verstappen. He was briefly ninth, actually, behind Kvyat after he rejoined, and then he got that place back. And then opportunistic pass on Bottas dived up the inside in the left-hand hairpin in the stadium. What do you make of that incident, and could he have won from there?
I think, personally, I think it would have been difficult for him to win from there. Max was fairly tight-lipped on the Bottas incident after the race, but Christian Horner was quite happy to speak about it afterwards. And he said on multiple occasions, answering different questions, that he believed that Max could have at least challenged for the win today. I think on pace, the car in Verstappen's hands was good. I think the overriding theme of the race was that the teams just didn't know how long those hard tyres were going to go. And I think if they all had hindsight, they could all go back and do things very differently. But Max obviously was forced into that long stint on the hard tyres because of the incident with Bottas. So he did over 60 laps on those tyres, which is over double what Ferrari were expecting that the tyres would go. So a pretty sensational stint on those tyres. And not just that, it was the speed that he showed. You know, he was, at one point he was quicker than all the leaders, but consistently through the stint he was on the you know, a similar pace to the leading car. So I definitely think it would have been in the conversation, but I still think Lewis was a bit too strong today on the race pace. But with the incident, it's I'd be interested to hear what you two think about the incident. But it was a brilliant opportunistic dive from Verstappen, and Scott, when we watched it, we sort of acknowledged that as a, you know, fantastic overtake. But obviously, it became clear a few corners later that there'd been contact there. And watching it back afterwards, Bottas didn't really have anywhere to go, but the runoff's there on the outside as well. So it's kind of like you kind of inviting Bottas to make the decision between attempting to make the corner and stay with Max or head to the runoff in you know, and hope he wasn't going to hit him in the right rear. But
I think, to be honest, Bottas was surprised by it, because you saw him with the lock on, and then when he saw Verstappen coming, he wound it off. And it's strange, actually, because he kind of avoided any kind of contact, and then it was just when he was coming back into the corner, he just clipped the... I think it was a Bottas misjudgment, actually.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that, because, like I said, the runoff's there. And I think you touched on it perfectly there with the surprise. I just think Bottas was completely taken aback by someone trying to overtake him there. And, you know, we've seen Max do this many times at different tracks, mate.
And he was focusing on Norris ahead as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I think if you had to place blame on that one, it would be a Bottas one. But I think I think the stewards are right not to give a penalty there.
I had a lot of sympathy for Verstappen, actually. He was absolutely the architect of his own downfall in qualifying. Should have been on pole. Ironically, I think he would have ended up in exactly the same position he was in at the first corner, whether he started pole or started fourth. But, you know, he's a victim of Lewis's error, or victim of circumstance through turn one into turn two. Admittedly, he plays a part in that by pushing Hamilton wide, but through no fault of his own does he get shoved or forced wide onto the grass there, and that compromises him by putting him back into that position behind Bottas. And then same again in going into that into the stadium section. It's not I don't remember seeing an overtake there on merit last year, Ed. I don't think I saw anyone else try it properly here this year other than Max. So again, one could argue, don't put your car in a place where there could be a problem, but what's the point in going racing if you're not going to try and pull a move? And it was, as Benyon said, brilliantly opportunistic. I thought it was an epic dive down the inside, completely caught Bottas napping. Bottas, complete misjudgment. It's entirely his fault. turning in, because he'd done really well to avoid Max steaming up the inside and then just sort of lapsed in the last bit. So Max has got the job done. At this point, you're thinking, right, okay, crack on. And then as he's coming down the start-finish straight, it looks like, initially, it just looks like Bottas is in the slipstream DRS and is blasting past. And then obviously it becomes quite clear it's not all as it seems. And then it turns out that he and his engineer had already been on the radio going down the start-finish straight to say right rear puncher and et cetera, et cetera. And then eventually the rubber comes completely off the rim, doesn't it, after he's already gone off and the time's been lost. So he has to go to the pits, plummets to last, and the race is ruined. And not in the space of what was it, 7 laps, something like that, maybe not even that, 5 or 6 laps, so he's gone from being in a position for, I think he was a, I'll go so far as saying Max was a nailed on podium in that race and a genuine victory contender, and he had that taken away from him through no fault of his own.
I think the only caveat I'd add is as well that obviously we're discussing this as if we're seeing Verstappen in his performance from after the puncture and adding sort of laying that over the races if he didn't have the puncture.
Yeah, you can't do that.
To explain that probably a little bit better. Obviously Verstappen's stint on the hards was incredible, but there's nothing to say that if, you know, he'd made that overtake perfect on Bottas and no puncture, that Red Bull wouldn't have put him on the same 2-stop as Albon, because at that point they didn't know that the hard tyre was going to last that long and that it was going to be the race tyre that it was. So I definitely think he would have been in for a podium.
I suspect they might have gambled on the 1-stop with him, because Albon, they committed to the 2-stop because they wanted to undercut Vettel. And at a guess, and this is just completely speculation, because Verstappen would have been trying to make up a few places still, I think they might have just thought, just leave him out if he's happy, and then that might have drifted them into the 1-stop situation, which could have meant he was involved in that group at the end.
Plus, almost regardless of strategy, I think you can chalk 10-15 seconds off Albon's race time for Verstappen, because he's a superior driver. He has been quicker all weekend. He would have had better pace. He'd have also had a fire under his backside as well. So I'm pretty convinced, because Albon at times in that race looked really, really good. I'm sure we'll probably get onto him maybe a little bit more in a bit. But Albon looked really good. I'm not trying to take away from the job he did, but we just know Max is at that elite level, isn't he? So I suspect he would have been properly in the mix, unless he managed to implode on his own later on. He's capable of that as well.
We'll put it this way. Verstappen's ahead of Bottas. Let's say the collision doesn't happen. Let's say Verstappen does end up going onto a one-stopper. He is in with that trio that are all running together at the end. So by definition, that means he's a victory contender. Whether he could get track position, that's another question. Yeah, that would have been extremely difficult.
Ultimately, he had just passed Bottas, and Bottas went on to finish third, didn't he? So,
well, this is a massive loss of the race. And the fantastic thing about that race was we had Hamilton and Vettel and Bottas all on one stops, but basically on completely different strategies. Had so many different strategies in that race, even for the people who were doing the same thing. And to have Verstappen in that mix as well just would have made the Grand Prix just that bit more exciting for me at the end.
Scott, so we had Leclerc leading from Vettel with Albon third, Hamilton and Bottas fourth and fifth once they'd got past the McLarens. So the big question was always who was going to blink first. In the end, it was Albon, followed a lap later by Leclerc. Now, it proves that was too early. The two-stopper wasn't the way to go, but were the moves understandable? Obviously, Albon launched the move in an attempt to undercut Vettel.
Yeah, it's kind of... Mattia Binotto, Ferrari team boss, sort of put it quite nicely, where he said that at the time it was difficult to judge. And then when you actually look back, it's quite obvious that they did the wrong thing. But Red Bull go aggressive. They bring in Albon in. He did a really good job in that first stint. He was hanging on to the Ferraris really nicely. Put himself in position where he can force the issue with the undercut. As soon as he forces that undercut, Ferrari has to respond with one of its drivers. I'm a little bit surprised that they went with Leclerc. I can only imagine, Binotto sort of hinted that Leclerc might have struggled a little bit to continue compared to Vettel, so maybe he was the most vulnerable and he's the race leader, so his position is the one that you want to protect the most in theory. So Leclerc then responds to Albon. They come in at the time. Team and driver think that they've made the right decision. And you then have a situation where Ferrari consider bringing Vettel in a lap later or swiftly afterwards. but they have a little bit of a discussion. Vettel questions it. They tell him to prepare as if he's boxing that lap. So he goes to push mode, come into the box, but then they decide against it and he goes on to extend the stint more than any of the other race leaders. By which point, obviously, Ferrari split the strategy. And that's at that point, I didn't really think the race had gone away from Leclerc. I actually thought, right, he's in a decent position here. As soon as we saw some of the lap times that Verstappen was doing on the hards as he sort of made his way through, and the fact that the longer the race went on and Ricciardo, for example, was extending that opening stint of his in the midfield, that's when it became clear that those that were one stopping, namely Hamilton, Vettel and Bottas, were slowly becoming more and more in the pound seat, to the point where even when Leclerc stopped again and you can see the immediate lap time he's able to do, it wasn't sustainable. So I do think in the first portion of the race, around the time of the first stops, the two-stop didn't look like the wrong decision. But as we often discuss in these scenarios, the second you commit to a two-stop when you know a one-stop is viable, you give away track position, which is king, even on a track where you've got an ultra-long start-finish rate.
I was surprised for several reasons, actually, at the timing. Not necessarily the two-stop, but Albon, they launched an undercut. The pit stop was fine. It was 2.2 seconds, according to the on-screen graphic. That's normally slightly off, but it wasn't like a 3.3 second. Sainz blasted past. So Albon lost several seconds on that outlap behind Sainz. So I don't know quite what Red Bull thought was going to happen there. I guess they assumed Albon would be able to somehow be ahead of Sainz into turn one, which I think was a miscalculation. So I think probably Albon went a lap early anyway in trying to do that undercut on Vettel. And I don't really see why Leclerc needed to cover him at that stage once they realised how much time Albon was losing. I know they didn't want to get undercut by Hamilton, whatever, but it was...
I wonder if they took their eye off of Albon once Albon actually got possibly. Come out.
Well, they'd have been worried about the ripple effect and others attacking. But if you look at it, actually, Leclerc versus Albon, I think Albon was about 4.5 seconds behind Leclerc when he pitted.
And then 8.8
and it was like 8.5. So actually, it was about like a 4 second loss or something. Albon actually made contact with Sainz on that outlap. They very, very light front left wheel to right left wheel just on the approach into turn six, the tight double apex. That caused problems for Albon. But yeah, I would definitely have preferred them to go onto hards just to keep options open, as you never know. And the whole thing with the hards, people constantly with whatever is the hardest compound say, oh, we didn't know enough about it. I know you don't have that much time in practice, but the number of times in races teams say, well, we didn't really know about the hards. It's like, well, put 20 laps on one car at some stage on a Friday and get a feel for what the wear is like, because the wear was non-existent on the hards and the deck wasn't particularly problematic. So it almost is one of those things where I feel Ferrari, that the danger wasn't that immediate, should we say. What they were worried about is Hamilton probably getting an undercut on both of them.
Well, to give you an indicator of how badly they misjudged it, Mattia Binotto said after the race that their indication was that you needed to run until lap 30 before putting the hards on, really, to go to the end on a one-stop properly. But as it turned out, as Verstappen proved, you could stop on lap 5, put the hards on and do a proper stint to the end.
Yeah, and there are some unknowns there, so you kind of understand these decisions weren't made by chance, but yeah, I think they weren't necessarily the best options, although I must admit at the time it did seem like a two-stopper would be the safer option, but we didn't get big offsets. But of course, once that happened, you kind of divided the race in two, in that we had Vettel, Hamilton and Bottas were one-stopping, and then Albon and Leclerc had ultimately condemned themselves to fifth and fourth place respectively by being on the two-stopper. So then it was a question of when do the one-stoppers come in, and eventually it was Lewis Hamilton who triggered that. He came in at the end of lap 23. Again, they thought about bringing Vettel in. They realised that the outlap pace of Hamilton was too good. He made up about 1.5 seconds on Vettel on that outlap, which meant that Vettel would have come out behind him. So they then decided to extend Vettel. So I guess, Scott, this is the big question. Should they have extended Vettel as long as they did? They were going to lose track position, but it was lap 23, Hamilton. Vettel went all the way to lap 37. He lost quite on top of that 1.5 seconds. Then there was about 6.7 seconds in the completed laps that was lost. So quite a lot of time was lost there.
There was, but I think at that point, they did make the right decision, because when we're talking about strategy in most races, how often do we see and question a decision to extend a stint by 3 or 4 laps, shed 4 or 5 seconds in race time with for a minimal offset? And in this scenario, Ferrari gave themselves a proper offset, but they gave themselves a big tyre offset in a race where actually it turned out that the tyres weren't the limiting factor. And that I think that goes back to your point about why leave the hard tyres such an unknown when it's going to be such a key part of the race. So they definitely could have done more in preparation there. But I can see the logic, because Binotto said once they realised that track position was gone, it was about, right, how long can we go giving ourselves a lot big an offset as possible so he's got fresher tyres at the end? Because if Hamilton's tyres had gone off the way I think the vast majority were expecting, then Vettel would have had him in the last few laps. And we saw that lap time that Vettel did straight out the box after pitting, and I thought Hamilton was a goner. I thought, that's it, hook, line and sinker, Ferrari have checkmated them. But that's not how it worked, because Vettel's pace slowed up pretty much immediately, and Hamilton just got quicker and quicker and quicker, and every time Vettel came at him, Hamilton was able to grow the lead back again.
I think if you look at it, it would have been interesting if Ferrari had responded immediately, but I don't think Vettel would have been able to regain track position. Where they lost it with Vettel was not being willing to take the same risk that Hamilton and Mercedes did by stopping as early as they did to go to the end. But again, when you've got the advantage, you're in the lead, do you necessarily do that? So it was ultimately Ferrari was in a slightly weak position because the car in like-for-like conditions wasn't quite as quick in the race as the Mercedes. I think Vettel maybe had a slight pace advantage of maybe a tenth or two in the final stint thanks to the tyre offset, but that was nowhere near enough, as he said after the race. So you ended up, you know, Lewis Hamilton, Sebastian Vettel, Valtteri Bottas, they all just circulated for this last chunk of the race. But it was great, really tense to watch, because you could see Vettel would take sort of 3 or 4 tenths out of Hamilton for a few laps, and then Hamilton would respond. And then there was still this question mark, because Vettel was being given fuel-saving instructions for a bit. And then they told him, right, no more saving, you're set. And I thought, okay, can he go? But he was never able to get close enough. So, I think it was just kind of a stalemate in the end there. And it was a race of strategy when push comes to shove. But we should say, really good drive from Hamilton, I think, because he did have some floor damage as well from the from what happened on the first lap. So that made it a little bit more difficult. He was worried about the tyre life and that kind of thing. And also, didn't have his race engineer, did he, Scott?
No, he didn't. So at those crucial moments where Lewis needed to get the job done, someone listening in and maybe expecting to hear the words, "Lewis, it's hammer time," The man who speaks those words was not around. Peter Bonington, Bono to I guess to most fans who listen. Bono must be, I think this is how we described him in the story when we wrote about Bono missing this race and Austin for a personal medical procedure back home. He must be the most recognisable behind the scenes voice in F1, because I reckon he's the only engineering personnel who, if you played their voice to someone who watches the races, they'd be able to name who they are.
Yeah, well, you always hear from him, and also the pure longevity of it as well, because he's been there with Hamilton since the start.
Yeah, exactly.
Hamilton's stint at Mercedes.
Seven years together, all of Lewis's Mercedes titles has been won with Bono, and he was sort of around in the background back home, because I think he was helping the race support team, and Lewis said he was still texting him for setup advice on the Saturday before qualifying, but no, but Bono wasn't around, so his race engineer role was taken by Marcus Dudley, and then forgive me for the bad pronunciation of your surname, chap, but Dom Riefstahl, who is normally heading up the race support team back at Brackley, was on site as performance engineer for Lewis, because that's what Dudley's role normally is. But Lewis and Toto Wolff were both full of praise for the job that Bono's replacement did. Toto said it was phenomenal. Lewis, nice little bit of self-awareness. He's not afraid to criticise himself. Said, "I know I'm not the most easy person to deal with. Having to deal with me over the radio isn't very fun for anybody. But he was full of praise for what Marcus did. So fair play, because I think Lewis described it as you could have seen it as a disadvantage coming into a crunch weekend without the person who's been your right-hand man for 7 years. But they equipped themselves very well. And it was probably a performance that Bono would have been absolutely proud of. I can very much imagine Bono being the one over the radio telling Lewis, no, come on, you can do this. I know you've got a million laps to do on these set of tyres, but you can do this.
They sent James Vowles on briefly.
Yeah, they did, didn't they? It's almost like a bit of an SOS. Come on, Lewis, I know you can do this. Please, please, please do this, because this strategy is a bit risky.
If I was Lewis Hamilton, I'd be terrified whenever James Vowles came on the radio, because it always means going wrong. And to be fair, Mercedes' strategy normally is very good. There's been a few cases when it hasn't been, but when you're at the top for so long, inevitably that's very, very obvious. But just occasionally we've heard that, you'd be thinking, oh, does that mean you don't think I can do it?
It would have been. I know that a Grand Prix isn't exactly a moment for sort of those sort of comedic highlights, but when Vowles came over the radio and said, "Lewis, it's James," he should have responded and said, "James, this is Lewis. I think you mean to be speaking to Valtteri." Because normally when we hear Vowles over the radio, a couple of times this year, it's basically been James coming on, say, "Valtteri, it's James. Yeah, sorry, but can you do this for the team, please?"
But we should say, yeah, the spot on with the strategy in this race. Yeah, they could gamble a little bit. They didn't have so much to lose, but all credit to them for going for it. Now, Jack, Sergio Perez, he won Class B, 7th place on home soil. As he said after the race, top three teams are in a different race. So great form for the home crowd. But we should also say, where did McLaren go? Because given Sainz and Norris were 4th and 6th and dicing with the Mercedes drivers early on. And suddenly at the end, there was Perez without a McLaren driver anywhere to be seen.
Yeah. Great nod to Perez for his performance this weekend. Bit of a difficult season for Racing Point in on the whole, but great performance from Perez today. And you know, rumours circulating there's been over 300,000 people attending over the course of the weekend, and obviously a lot of them back in Sergio. So great to see him doing well. And every time there was a lap in the media centre, we were watching on the screen. You knew when Perez was coming into the stadium section, because you'd literally hear the crowd roaring through the media centre wall. And the media centre isn't that close to the stadium section, so fantastic to hear that. But yeah, it was just a bit of a capitulation from McLaren, really. Sainz had a nailed on sixth place, was ahead of Hamilton at one point after the start, and his pace on the hard tyre was just non-existent. Norris was a little bit better, but he was obviously taken out of the equation with the start melee, and then the front left wheel, the thread on the wheel proving problematic. He got going again, but he was so far behind at that point that he was completely out of the equation. So yeah, Sainz said switched off was the phrase he used on two or three different occasions in his answer about what had happened with the hard compound tyre. So he said the car just switched off, the rear grip switched off, and we started going backwards. He did say, and it's one of them things that happens once in a year, so I'm sure they'll be hoping that they pick up the pace. But Lando says they've got a lot of work to do on the car for Austin, that there's a bit of looking inward for Lando with his driving, but also there's a bit of work for the team to do as well. So it'll be interesting to see if they can bounce back in Austin.
Just picking up on what you said about the crowd, 345,694 was the official weekend attendance that F1 have put out not long ago. I've got an email with that on, so I thought I'd throw that in. But yeah, I don't think there was much Sainz could have really done about it, although Norris was a little bit better off because he was cracking on. He was struggling as well. The pace wasn't great. So I think, yeah, it was just one of those days where it didn't work, and Sainz isn't always at his best when the rear's unstable. So,
And one more thing on Perez as well. He held off charging Ricciardo at the end, which can never be an easy thing, regardless of how good the Renault was. You got the honey badger coming at you and trying to fight and hunt you down in the last few laps of the race. That can never be easy. So he did well to hold him off as well. It wasn't like just because the McLarens weren't there that Perez was gifted an easy seventh place. He worked hard to get it.
It's funny, after the race, he was asked about that moment and he sort of said, yeah, well, Ricciardo hasn't got a Red Bull anymore to do those lunges. So I think that probably helped Perez to hold on to that position as well, because obviously it gave Ricciardo a flat spot and meant that he was safe. But, you know, Perez has had a really, really good season, actually. I think he's shown, in comparing to what Stroll's been doing, he's shown that he's getting kind of the best out of that car as we expect. And he's had a run of decent results now since the Singapore upgrade. The Racing Point's livened up a little bit, because they've had a long run of races where they're 11th, 12th, 13th a lot of the time. But he also, of course, benefited from being the fastest of those not in Q3. So he was delighted to be starting 11th with a free tyre choice.
I can't wait for that rule to change.
Well, it's a stupid rule.
It's ridiculous.
Actually, it was a sensible rule once, but it's there to allow those a bit lower down to attack those at the front, whereas all it does is it means those at the front get a bigger advantage because they can start on the better race tyre if the medium's better. And then those who are at the front of the midfield lose out because they all drop back. They all lost track position, the two Toro Rossos and the two McLarens. Well, Norris had his problem anyway, but he was going to lose it anyway. So, yeah, it's a rule that it probably is going to be changed for next year, although it's not 100% certain, but it would be sensible to do so. But yeah, Perez 7th, Ricciardo 8th. Now, we did have a bit of drama at the end, Scott. Hülkenberg was 9th on the last lap. He had Kvyat behind him and Gasly there as well. And it looked like it was going to be 7th and 8th for Renault, but then Kvyat sort of stuck his nose into the, barely even his nose, into that the turn 16, the right-hander that's effectively the last corner. The turn 17 is a sort of long, flat-out one. Kvyat was very angry about the 10-second penalty he got that dropped him to 11th and put Hülkenberg back up to 10th and Gasly to 9th. So do you agree with him that this was an outrageous anti-racing decision?
Not really. I actually quite admired Hülkenberg's position on it, which was, well, you know, he's got to have a go because we're racing drivers. It's close. It's the last lap. It's a chance to get more points. So, yeah, fair play. But
he also knew at that point that Kvyat had a penalty.
Yeah.
Because he was saying that, oh, I was there speaking to him. We had a big timing screen behind us. So if he hadn't already been told, he knew that the penalty had happened.
Yeah, but he's just said...
You can be a bit more relaxed about it when
yeah,
you know...
Yeah, but he said, like, if you're going to do that, you've got to do it in a way that doesn't result in the other car going into the wall. And
yeah.
As soon as he turned Hulk round and the Renault went backwards into the barrier and broke the rear wing, I was actually quite surprised in that instance that Hülkenberg got going and crossed the line in a position whereby he could inherit a point again when Kvyat got punished.
It shows you should never go up. But that move wasn't on really. It was too far back, and it was just. But the irony is, from a Toro Rosso perspective, it was actually a net gain because Kvyat was 10th before that. And it ended up as a result with Pierre Gasly being bumped up to 9th place. So it gave an extra point to Toro Rosso and denied Renault a point. So there was actually a gain in the Constructors' Championship there as well. And we should say to Gasly, I think he deserved a little bit of luck at the end because he was very ill overnight before qualifying with what might be called generic unpleasant illness. And he did look, spoke to him after qualifying, you could see he was struggling and he said, well, I felt all right once I got in the car, but he knew his concentration, his sharpness wasn't quite there, and he was only a tenth and a bit behind Kvyat in qualifying. But and of course he dropped back, he struggled more with the tyres than Kvyat, got through them quicker and lost ground. So I think he deserved a little bit of luck to pick up a ninth place, especially as not only was he ill, but he's had a really good run since returning to Toro Rosso. I've been very impressed with Gasly.
There were about 150 odd people, I reckon, apparently in the paddock that were affected. And I reckon that number probably increased from Saturday morning.
Alex Albon voiced the rumour that it was related to a toilet block in the middle of the paddock.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
But I don't know whether that's...
Full of conspiracy theories.
Well, exactly.
First you claim that Daniel Kvyat purposefully took out Hülkenberg to give Gasly an extra place, and now you're claiming that a toilet in the middle of the paddock is caused a bug that has affected everybody.
Credit to Daniel Kvyat. Also spoke to him after qualifying. He had his antibacterial hand gel with him. I'm all for let them race, but... That was not an on move. It wasn't deliberate. I think it was just a bit of desperation almost, but it worked out all right for Toro Rosso, didn't it?
So absolutely. I'll be a bit more serious now, and I've got Kvyat's words that he spoke to our Russian colleague. Kvyat doesn't speak exclusively to Russians. It just so happens that our Russian loves him. So he was speaking to Oleg Karpov, and Kvyat said that he didn't want to say too much because he's still very upset about it. But as a racing driver, he strongly disagrees with it. They told us we can race, we're allowed to race. I agree with you there, Danny, but you're also not allowed to put someone else in the wall. But there's one bit where he says, I think people like to see some racing, and if we get penalised for it, they just kill the sport like this. I don't like what the stewards do sometimes.
No, he's just wrong.
He is wrong.
He's just absolutely flat wrong.
There's nothing better than a driver says, I don't want to say much about this when they open with, because you know it's just going to be followed by a tirade of
what
throwing
they mean
their
is,
cards
what,
on the table.
What they mean is, I know I shouldn't say much about this, but yeah, it's too far. Yeah, but the move's got to be on and somewhere near working. It wasn't like he went up the inside, had a massive back out of it, and it just sort of happened. It was just it was just too little, too late, really.
That's the differentiation. He came from so far back. It just the move just wasn't on. If that had been a wheel to wheel incident where Kvyat's got the front half of his car down the inside just before the corner and then makes the dive, then you could almost make a case for that being a racing incident, but he was just so far back. There's not even close to being a racing incident.
Well, while we're talking about Hülkenberg, we should very briefly mention the news that broke actually after we'd recorded our last podcast, which was that the Renaults were disqualified from the Japanese Grand Prix for this brake bias infringement. Don't want to go into it in too much depth, but effectively they didn't prove any of the technical regulations that Racing Point had accused them of breaking were infringed, but they did say it broke the catch-all sporting regulation that the driver must drive the car alone and unaided. So slightly vague one, but it's fairly clear that Renault was running with a system that they weren't really meant to, although, as Romain Grosjean revealed, they've been running that system for a very, very long time.
Yeah, Grosjean said been on the car since 2015 when the team was formerly known as Lotus, so it's been around for a while. And Cyril Abitbol said that they hadn't sought clarification from the FIA that the design on the 2019 car was legal because it's been on the car for so long they had no reason to think it wasn't legal. And you're right. The FIA found that it didn't breach any of the technical regulations, and Abitbol and Renault were very keen to point that out. To stress that I think they feel that they were stitched up a little bit by a contradiction in the rules, because you've got technical regulations that clearly allow this device, but a sporting regulation that doesn't. And that sporting regulation, I agree with Abitbol, is very subjective. And Abitbol said it's not fit for purpose because it's too vague, basically, for the complexities of a modern F1 car. And I'm actually inclined to agree. It's a bit, when you've got things like automatic preset energy recovery system modes and stuff like that, the ins and outs of the system, because a lot of it was kept confidential, it is a bit tricky to explain, and my head around it completely.
What it wasn't was it wasn't 100% fully automated. The brake bias sorts itself out every corner based on distance around the lap, which is kind of what Racing Point seemed to suggest in their original claim. So it's a little bit more about engaging presets and meaning that the driver has to do one thing rather than three or four.
It's like semi-automatic, isn't it?
Yeah, some kind of pre-selection going on, but yeah, it's one of those things. I mean, the driving the car alone and unaided, there's a few rules there that are deliberately catch-alls, and you kind of need them. So the alone and unaided is one of them. The movable aerodynamic device has been used for all sorts of things over the years, some very legitimately, some less so. And then there's the general philosophy, which is what Charlie Whiting always used to talk about, which is the primary purpose, that if you've got something that's legal that is clearly not actually doing what it's meant to be doing, like if you have a fan that's blowing into the back of the car and its primary purpose really is for ground effect or whatever, I'm going back to 78 Brabham here, rather than for cooling, then it's, come on, you're taking liberties there. So I do think you do have to have these little catch-alls, although whether the reaction was appropriate is another question. But Ricardo said it was a very, very small help, but hardly a driver aid, really. It made no difference, and it didn't really cause them any trouble to adapt to. So, but another blow for Renault. And of course, they had their, the boss of Renault said they'll consider the F1 team's future as part of their widespread review of the whole company as well. So it's in what's a very difficult season for Renault. That's just another thing on top of another thing.
Yeah, it's just not helpful, is it? It's bad PR. And it's another example of the team failing to build proper momentum. As Ricardo put it, every time something good happens, either the good thing's removed quite quickly or it's followed up by something negative.
Yeah, just can't get the momentum. Momentum, can they? Can't say the word. Well, who else do we have here? Daniel Kvyat, of course, was 11th. Lance Stroll was 12th. He briefly got up to 10th place, but was really struggling on the hard, so lost a few places towards the end. Then Carlos Sainz Jr. in 13th place. He never managed to recover. He made a second stop, got back onto mediums, but the 20 or so laps he was on hards ruined his race. Antonio Giovinazzi in the Alfa Romeo. The Alfa just wasn't very quick. Giovinazzi, slightly slower than Raikkonen in qualifying, drove a pretty decent race, but just nothing he could do ultimately. You can say the same thing for Kevin Magnussen in the Haas, which was a struggle. Kimi Raikkonen in the other Alfa Romeo got sandwiched between Russell and Magnussen on the first lap, picked up a bit of floor damage, then the car was overheating and eventually retired. It's quite bad for Alfa Romeo that the car just doesn't seem to be very competitive. It just doesn't have the grip. Raikkonen said the balance was all right, wasn't problematic, but just not enough grip. So they need to do some work with that car to get it working. Just completing the quick summary. Yeah, George Russell 16th and Robert Kubica 18th. Kubica was nowhere in qualifying, something like 1.3 seconds down, and most of that gap was in the middle sector with the fast S's where he was really struggling. But actually in the race he ran quite well. He got ahead of Russell, lost the position to a slow pit stop. He stopped before Russell. Russell stopped a lot later, but Russell was ahead of him because of Kubica's slow stop. And then he did a wonderful move into turn six, the double apex slow right-hander to nick the position back off Russell.
George had made up places at the start and then also on the first lap dropped back again.
He got very hung out to dry on the outside.
Yeah, exactly. And then ended up behind Kubica. And we asked him after the race whether he thought he should have been let past Kubica, because there was, you know, quite a fair chunk of that race where he was the quicker driver. And he said, in typical George Russell fashion, no, because he would have liked to have been let past, but he knows that if he was Robert, he would be furious if he was told to move out of the way. So George was very eloquent about that, but he did feel that they could move up two places if he'd have been let past and let loose. So that was interesting.
It's possible. It didn't happen until nine laps from the end, in fact, when Kubica picked up a slow puncher and had to pit. It's strange, actually. The gap between them extended to as much as 10 seconds at one stage when Russell didn't have the rubber, the green with the blue flags, and then it sort of went back again when Kubica lost a load of time to blue flags. But yeah, the Williams was pretty quick. Its relative gap to the front was not good, but only about 0.3 off the back of the midfield for George Russell. So that was very positive for them. They had some, I think, cooling spec tweaks as well, so they're not overcooling the car quite so much, and just small little incremental steps. Williams have to take what victories they can ultimately.
Well, obviously they've introduced the new front wing, and it was the first time in qualifying that both cars had run the new front wing. Dave Robson and George Russell both kind of saying that it was 50-50 the reason for the performance between the new updates that they brought, including the front wing, but also the characteristics of Mexico suited the Williams and brought it back towards the midfield. So yeah, new updates come in and they expect them to be much more effective in the coming races rather than Mexico, but it was just a nice bonus that the car seemed to work fairly well there.
But overall, coming back to what happened at the front, Lewis Hamilton's victory didn't quite give him the world championship, but I think he only needs an eighth place at worst, effectively, to win the title. 4 points, I think, is what he needs. He needed a 78 lead, didn't he, but he only had 74. Realistically, it's over, but chances are it'll be done in Austin. Obviously, Valtteri Bottas will continue to say he's going to keep trying while it's open, in the hope of a miracle. But yeah, we can expect a coronation, I think, in the United States in a few days, and also a continuation of these fascinating battles. It's great when you've got a car that's stronger in qualifying, and then others that are stronger in the race. It's why we've had this run of consistently good races. And actually, people always complain about in Formula One, the pole position driver always wins, but that's not happened a great deal this year.
Especially when the car that puts it on pole is Ferrari, because they've got a beautiful habit, haven't they, of just failing to string it together. What's this? It's the third race in a row that Ferrari's been on par when Mercedes has won.
Yeah. And Charles Leclerc's had 7 poles this year, so nobody's going to have more poles than him this year. And he might end up with the outright most, which is, it's been fascinating season from that perspective. Well, please do check out allsport.com for all the latest from Formula One and the rest of the world of motorsport. Loads of fallout from the Mexican Grand Prix there. This Allsport podcast, of course, is out every Monday or Thursday. We'll have a United States Grand Prix preview later in the week. And do check out Autosport Magazine, which is out on Thursday, sister titled motorsport.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast. Music is 6 AM by Trilo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trilo Music.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky?
In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Wendy's knows cold and soggy fries are the worst.
So soggy.
That's why we're serving up hot and crispy fries all day, every day.
And all night. Until close.
With natural cut potatoes, sea salted to perfection.
Show me that potato skin.
Wendy's hot and crispy aren't like other fries. We're your dream fry. Choose wisely. Choose Wendy's hot and crispy fries.
Guaranteed to be hot and crispy. If yours aren't, bring them back and we'll replace them.
Sports Social Podcast Network.